This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes.
Hello. On the 21st of October 1805, Horatio Nelson led the British fleet to a famous victory over the French and Spanish fleets at the Battle of Trafalgar. It became a defining moment for how Britain saw itself, and for Spain too, where people couldn't understand why they'd fallen in with the French and soon fell out with them. In France, meanwhile, the defeat went unreported, and even before Nelson's grand state funeral at St. Paul's, Napoleon had crushed Austria and Russia at Austerlitz, his greatest victory. With me to discuss the Battle of Trafalgar are Kenneth Johnson, Research Professor of National Security at Air University, Alabama, Marianne Chisnick, an independent researcher on Nelson and editor of his Letters to Lady Hamilton, and James Davy, lecturer in naval and maritime history at the University of Exeter. James Davy, why were Britain and France at war in 1805?
Well, the first thing to say is that wars between Britain and France were very common across the long 18th century. In some ways, the war that broke out in 1803 did so for entirely traditional reasons, namely concerns over the balance of power in Europe. So on one hand, Britain was nervous about French designs on Egypt and Switzerland. And on the other, France was very angry that Britain had refused to give up the island of Malta in the Mediterranean, which they'd agreed to do as part of the Treaty of Amiens. So you have two sides frustrated and nervous around each other. And the early months of 1803 see a slide to war, which comes about in May 1803 when Britain does declare war. The other thing worth mentioning, though, is that although the war broke out for quite traditional reasons, this is a period where the nature of war is changing. Prompted by the French Revolution, war now means vast conscript armies and conflicts that are being fought for national survival. And I think a really good example of this is the vast army that Napoleon is building on the northern coast of France, ready to invade Britain as soon as an opportunity arises.
But how real was that threat of invasion? How real did the British feel that they were going to be invaded by the French fleet?
We know there was no successful invasion of Britain by France in this period. But what I think the most important point is, though, that people at the time in Britain were very much worried about the threat of invasion. The government certainly was very concerned. They directed vast resources to improving the numbers of militia and volunteers, lots of resources spent on building defence works in southern England. Certainly the government were taking this threat very seriously. If we look at sort of diaries and letters that have been passed down from this period too, we also get a sense of the greater British public being very concerned and anxious about this. And we also know that the Navy itself was spent the first 2 years of the war blockading French invasion flotillas' imports. Certainly naval commanders and the men that were involved in these operations were very, very concerned about what they saw as a very realistic threat. Remember as well that you only have to go back to 1797 for the last time that France had successfully landed an army on British soil, when a small force was mobilised and deployed near Fishguard in Wales.
Thank you. Marianne Chisnick, why was Nelson already so famous in Britain in 1805?
His fame was created really by the Battle of the Nile that had been such a stunning victory for several reasons. It was decisive The 11 British ships took 9 of the 11 French ships. It was dramatic, with the French flagship blowing up at the height of the battle. And it was important because it thwarted the conquest of General Napoleon Bonaparte in the Orient and thus the imperial ambitions of France in that part of the world. By doing this, it averted a threat to British interests in India and generally created comfort back home that the French were not invincible. There had been a series of reassuring victories, I should say, in the 1790s of different admirals, of whom only Nelson was still at sea. So the attention was focusing on him. And also he had an element of personal attractiveness, I should say. His love affair, though damaging to his career, added to the affection in which he was held by his compatriots. They wouldn't make him commander-in-chief after his return from the Mediterranean, from the Battle of the Nile. He was only second in command in the Baltic. So that was a damage, which can be explained by his pretty outrageously publicly lived affair with Lady Hamilton.
Can you sketch out, Marianne, why sea power was so important to Britain at that time?
There was a threat of invasion, which was very much felt in the public. And in this situation, the Navy seemed to be the saviour of Britain. Lord of the Admiralty, First Lord of the Admiralty put it that way, I don't say the French cannot come, but I say that cannot come by sea. So all hope was concentrated on the Navy. And within the Navy, Nelson was the most popular, reassuring figure at the time.
Thank you. Kenny Johnson, Nelson's opponent at Trafalgar was to be Villeneuve. How did they compare? Can you tell us something about Villeneuve?
Pierre-Charles Villeneuve was a competent professional officer of noble birth who had served under the Bourbons, the French Revolutionary Governments, and later Napoleon. He had been promoted to contre-amiral in 1796. And as Marianne mentioned, the Battle of Aboukir Bay, that's his first major battle as a commander, where he is leading the rear division. A side note of importance is one of the frigates is captained by Denis de Crée, his future boss, the Minister of the Navy under Napoleon. And the key thing is to see that he doesn't really have a lot of opportunities for command. In 1802, he commands a small division of two ships that goes out to retake possession of Martinique. Upon his return in the summer of 1803, he takes command of the Rochefort Squadron. This is the smallest squadron of France. What really changes is in August 1804 is the death of Amiral Latouche Tréville, who was Napoleon's primary admiral. And when Napoleon is looking for a replacement, he really has very few options. You have Eustache Bruy, who is the commander of the flotilla, and he's literally dying from tuberculosis. He'll die in the following March. And you have another admiral, Rosy Merzos, who has never commanded a fleet and had last commanded a ship as part of a scientific expedition 15 years before. So pretty much by default, Villeneuve, without any mention of his record, is the one who's selected to command the Toulon fleet in October 1804. And as we read Villeneuve's letters, he's really of fragile mental state, as he's not really used to commanding such a large fleet.
Napoleon had wanted to lure the British away from the Channel across to the Caribbean, which would have been a smart move. How did it work out?
It worked out somewhat successful. Nelson was famously fixated on Egypt, and so every time Villeneuve set out to sea, Nelson believed that that's where the French were heading. Now, Napoleon fed counterintelligence to help make them believe this, and had things gone differently, Calder's squadron that's off of the coast of Ferrol nearly finds himself surrounded by three French fleets and squadrons. You had Villeneuve returning with his 20 ships. You had the Franco-Spanish fleet at Ferrol with another 15 ships. And then you have the Rochefort squadron of 5 ships that slip out to sea again. And it's really only by the poor performance of this Franco-Spanish fleet at the Battle of Cape Finisterre, as well as the unpreparedness of the Ferrol fleet, that allows Calder to really escape a very precarious position. At this point, Villeneuve had increased the size of his fleet to 29 ships. But of course, as we know, Villeneuve, with frayed nerves, frustrated by contrary winds, will instead decide to head to Cadiz. And at that point, Napoleon calls off the invasion in August 1805.
the invasion threat was over. By August 1805, Russia and Austria have entered the war on Britain's side. So Napoleon's forces in northern France up sticks and move away from the coast to counter this new threat from the east. So for all intents and purposes, the threat of invasion is over in August 1805. And what's more, people in Britain know this too. Newspapers are reporting, you know, who have spent the last 2 years publishing these very detailed accounts of French invasion preparations, you know, suddenly start celebrating that the threat of invasion is over. These troops are now moving away to a different part of Europe.
In October 1805, the British wanted a battle, but the French didn't. Why did the French then, why did they sail out of Cadiz on October the 18th if they didn't want to fight?
Why then does Napoleon order this fleet to leave Cadiz? I mean, so ostensibly it is to support an expedition to the Isle of Sicily. I mean, it seems a really curious decision. There's certainly a sense that perhaps Napoleon, frustrated with the French Navy's actions over the last year or so, just decided to throw them into the fight in whatever way he could. Villeneuve understood that this was a foolhardy mission, that if he encountered the British Navy, the French-Spanish fleet was going to be in trouble.
One of the reasons why he wants the fleet to leave Cadiz is pretty devoid of supplies. Mm. The Spanish had been caught off guard by war as well, right? The Spanish were trying desperately to stay neutral, paying Napoleon basically to not have to partake in the alliance. And so when the war starts, when the British attack their treasure fleet, the Spanish Navy is even less prepared for this war than the French are. And so now you have a large combined fleet of 30 plus ships that are consuming all the supplies. The key crucial factor is Villeneuve is very worried about being replaced. And Villeneuve learns on the 18th of October that Admiral Rosy, the prior admiral that I had mentioned with no combat experience recently, is now making his way across Spain. And Villeneuve quickly deduces that Rosy has been sent out to replace him. And that's when he orders the fleet out to sea.
Mariana, could you set the scene of the battle on the 21st of October in the morning? They're lined up against each other. Can you tell us what it looked like, an aerial view?
The aerial view would make it difficult to get a pattern. The Franco-Spanish line was in a kind of crescent, but so widespread over such distances that one could hardly see what the pattern where the line was. And the same with the British fleet. They had to keep long distances, not to endanger ships crashing into each other. The idea that is usually given in charts of the battle of two clearly formed narrow lines, divisions of the British approaching a line of the Franco-Spanish fleet is misleading. So one would see a widely scattered image of ships.
The Franco-Spanish fleet is just a scattered mess of ships out of place, further leeward than they should be, in many cases with large gaps that were not intended.
In the age of sail, the ship's guns were pointed sideways, so that in order to bring their greatest firepower to bear, ships had to turn their sides to the enemy, and fleets traditionally formed a line of ships, the so-called line of battle. Nelson's plan was not to fight in such a line. He planned to focus on the enemy at the center and rear of their line, so that the vanguard of the enemy's line would sail on and not be able to interfere in the battle. This idea of overwhelming the enemy at the center and rear required that the French and Spanish would not understand Nelson's approach, because otherwise their ships could have reacted. Nelson explained his aim to a friend a few weeks before the battle. "I think I will surprise and confound the enemy. They won't know what I am about." This surprising and confounding required not to spend too much time rearranging a fleet. In Nelson's words, the order of sailing will be the order of battle. It also required to sail at speed, with all sails set towards the enemy. This was extremely risky and had never been done before, because it exposed the British ships, the approaching ships, to the enemy's fire and to the additional danger of sails catching fire, a considerable threat. The division led by his second-in-command, Admiral Collingwood, would sail down onto the rear of the enemy's line at right angles. Nelson's line, by contrast, would approach the enemy's extended line in a line ahead formation, that is, one ship after the other. And at the moment of closing in onto the enemy's line, Nelson would turn his ship, the Victory, and attack not the vanguard, but the center of the French line with the flagship of the commander-in-chief. And this actually managed to confuse the enemy.
Kenny Johnson, so how did the French and Spanish respond to what Nelson was doing? We've gone some way to it with Mariana. Can you take that on?
Mm-hmm. The Franco-Spanish fleet that sails out Trafalgar is really not well prepared for this battle. Half of the ships had not partaken in the shakedown cruise out to the Caribbean. Half of the ships, they'd only been out to sea when they left Ferrol for that six-day cruise. Two-thirds of the sailors aboard had not been out to sea ever before. And three of the Spanish ships had cruised so weak that they weren't even expected to fight. They were just to follow the fleet. Now, what happens is Villeneuve is actually setting sail. He's heading southeast, and he sees Nelson's formation, and he rightfully fears that Nelson's plan is to cut off his rear guard. And so what he does is, at 8 o'clock, Villeneuve orders the fleet to wear about together. So this means, like, synchronously the entire fleet turns around, which is a very difficult maneuver to do with an inexperienced crew. And so what this does is creates even further disruption within the French line. Some ships move to engage the British as they close in. Others prefer to keep their distance and fire from afar, but by doing so, even create further gaps that are exploitable.
How many were there on the Franco-Spanish side?
I believe it's 33 ships of the line.
And the British were 27, weren't they?
The British were 33, originally had been 33 too, but a little squadron had been sent for victualling off the coast of northern Africa. And so they were reduced to the number of 27. And that's why Nelson had also to reduce the number of divisions in which he wanted to fight the battle. He had thought of three divisions, and in the end, there were only two.
So as near as damn it, it was equal. The numbers.
Yeah, and I think what creates the lopsidedness of the battle is once this becomes a melee, you know, at the beginning, the British suffer a lot of casualties as the first ships are taking the combined firepower of all the French and Spanish ships. But once it breaks down into a melee, then the cohesion of the British Navy wins out in these small one-on-one, two-on-one engagements. And that's where you start to see the casualties and captured ships start to pile up on the French and Spanish side.
As Nelson was approaching the Franco-Spanish combined fleets, everything had been arranged by Nelson. And he felt, oh, why not send out this message? And when the flag signals went up, his second-in-command, Collingwood, said, oh, what is he signaling? We know what to do. And then came a practically useless signal, which was revolutionary in, for the first time, addressing any ordinary sailor by saying England expects, Nelson originally wanted to say confides, but that would have been too tricky to spell out in the signals. So England expects that every man will do his duty.
James Derby, what was it like for the sailors taking part in that kind of battle? Can you give us some factual evidence?
The short answer is terrifying. Marianne talked earlier about, you know, the need for the British fleet to approach the combined fleet at speed, but it doesn't really work out like that. And on the morning of the 21st of October, you have these two fleets moving towards each other really quite slowly, just a few knots. And so this gives those about to take part in this battle time to think about what lies ahead, to ponder their likely fates. So if you can imagine ships on both sides being hives of activity as they slowly move towards each other, sailors and officers alike taking the opportunity to eat something, many of them writing letters home to loved ones, letting them know that they were thinking of them just in case the worst happens. You also have some individuals that scratch out sort of makeshift wills. Think also about all of the preparations for fighting. So you would have had weapons brought up from down below. One of the things that always strikes me when reading about this battle is sand would have been spread over the decks, partly to help sailors grip the floor, but also to soak up blood, because this is what happens in naval battles. Down below in ships as well, you would have had surgeons, you know, preparing their tools, the tools of their trade, ready for the likely injuries that were coming their way. I mean, in the battle itself...
They were hull-to-hull at certain stages, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So Nelson's tactics meant that at the moment that they hit the French and Spanish line, they could begin to return fire. And at that point, you have ships that drift off next to each other in this melee, one-on-one, two-on-one battles all over the place. And it becomes incredibly chaotic. And in these sort of ship-on-ship actions, that natural instinct between fight or flight was removed because there's nowhere to run. I mean, I suppose theoretically you can run to the lower part of the ship, but frankly, if a ship starts taking on water, the one place you don't want to be is down below in the hold. So you have these really intense battles with sailors on both sides for trying to keep up the rate of fire as best they can. Cannonballs and splinters flying through the air. It's also chaotic. As soon as you've fired a few broadsides, smoke would have engulfed the ship. It would have been very difficult to see, you know, more than a few, you know, 20 or 30 yards away. Do you mind if I quote one participant in the battle? Because I think it gives a really good sense of the intense nature of these fights, but also the chaos. So it's by a Welsh Marine lieutenant called Lewis Rotley, who was writing about the battle a few years later. And this is what he said. A man should witness a battle in a three-decker from the middle deck, for it beggars all description. It bewilders the senses of sight and hearing. There was fire from above, the fire from below, besides the fire from the deck I was upon. The guns recoiling with violence, reports louder than thunder, the decks heaving and the sides straining. I fancied myself in the infernal regions where every man appeared a devil. Lips might move, but orders and hearing were out of the question. Everything was done with signs. It's also worth mentioning that there are, of course, lots of stories of heroism and bravery during this battle, but we have to try and remember these were human beings with very real human emotions. I mean, there are other combatants that after the battle recorded that they would see people further along the deck fall and thank God that it wasn't them that was falling.
How would you assess the caliber of fighting skills between the British and their opponents?
There is very little doubt that British gunnery was superior to that of the French and Spanish. Put simply, they could fire more quickly, more accurately, and the weapons that they were using were more reliable as well. But I think the other part of that question, or the answer to that question, is about the sort of morale and fighting spirit, if you like. And I think in that instance, there was no difference. I think many, many British onlookers were surprised at the quality of some of the seamanship on display on the other side and complimented the French and Spanish on how well they fought.
Mariana, how did Nelson die? One of the things that's most famous about Battle of Trafalgar is that at the height of victory, he knew he'd won, as it were, Nelson died. Can you go through that, please?
The fatal bullet hit him at the height of the battle when approach and attack had been finished and his involvement was not needed anymore. He lived to learn of his victory and he died when the last shots were fired. But I would like to connect to what James said. Of course, death was terrible, horrific for Nelson too. His death was even probably like arbitrary because he was killed by an old outsized musket ball that wouldn't have fitted into a slim modern French musket barrel. So one can assume this bullet had been used as a kind of shrapnel that was just fired at random into the smoke on Victory Stack and just hit Nelson as it could have hit anybody else. And as to the pain Nelson was suffering, unlike many accounts of his death make us believe, with him talking to whomever came along, he could hardly connect more than a few uninterrupted words. What I find most remarkable about Nelson's dying moments is how he managed to convince those around him that he was indeed dying, because that's what they tried to hide from him. They tried to cheer him up, that he himself would bring the news of the victory to Britain. And even when Nelson insisted, "It's nonsense to suppose that I can live," those around him just went on telling him that he should not despair of living and that he should trust in divine providence. Nelson, whose forces were rapidly diminishing, helped the ship's surgeon to admit the truth. He reminded him that all motion and feeling below my breast are gone, and you very well know I can live but a short time. And the surgeon himself had to turn away to hide his tears. And only then Nelson was able to take his farewell, expressing his wishes for his mistress, Lady Hamilton, and asking his friend, Captain Hardy, when he came below decks to see him one last time, to kiss him goodbye, really.
Kenny Johnson, what did Napoleon make of the events of that day?
Napoleon doesn't really have a strong reaction. Prior to this, when Napoleon's getting reports of Villeneuve's actions, he is constantly ranting and raving against Villeneuve, calling him a coward and the worst of mankind. So Napoleon learns of the defeat of Trafalgar on about, I think it's 18th of November, while he's conducting, of course, the operations against Austria. This is prior to the Battle of Austerlitz, but after the Battle of Ulm. And he writes to the Minister of the Navy, Denis de Creye, and literally says, quote, "Nothing has changed regarding my projects for future cruises." Villeneuve is eventually paroled, and he comes back to France in April 1806. But it's very clear that he's mentally distraught from the size of the defeat. It's a very strong blow. The Spanish Navy is pretty decimated. Two of the fleets are shattered. Only the Cartagena fleet is left. He's most likely going to stand in a court-martial. But when Villeneuve learns that said court-martial is going to be postponed, he basically commits suicide.
What is the comparative damage to the British fleet?
Britain loses zero ships in terms of ships that were captured or sunk, and proportionally much, much fewer casualties too. The British Navy at Trafalgar has some ships that received but barely any casualties. I mean, for the most part, it was fought by the first few ships in Nelson's squadron and the first few ships in Collingwood's. Nelson's victory, the Temeraire, which afterwards became known as the Fighting Temeraire because of the number of casualties it had sustained. There were a few ships at the end of each British line that didn't come into the battle until very, very late.
And probably we shouldn't forget what it mattered to have an organized fleet after the battle. In the storm, when the British had to take the prizes and had to manage to sail them all, keeping a distance from the dangerous shore, and that was quite a feat as well for several days to keep these damaged ships at sea.
Can you tell us the response to the death of Nelson back in England, in London, and in Britain generally?
In Britain, the public response was one of genuine sorrow. Obviously, there were numerous people celebrating the victory, but that was very much compromised by the news that Nelson had died. He had become a celebrity, very much a hero in British society, and his death brought genuine sorrow to people. And newspapers carried the story in great detail. Workshops and factories shut down. People went around wearing ribbons commemorating his death. And in the years after the battle, there was this outpouring of material culture produced that venerated Nelson's image, all kinds of things, you know, prints, coins, pieces of clothing, textiles, ceramicware, all of which had sort of Nelson's name, face, and famous mottos emblazoned on them, particularly this "England expects that every man will do his duty." There's definitely a very public sense of sorrow. It's worth contrasting that, though, with the reaction of the government, which I think is a lot more cynical about how it deals with the news. I think the government knows full well that Trafalgar has done very little to shape the course of the war. As reports come back, as Vice Admiral Collingwood's dispatches arrive, it's pretty clear that whilst Britain has captured and sunk a number of enemy ships, a lot have escaped. And of course, the Admiralty and the British government would have known that there were plenty of other French fleets stationed around Europe. And so they know the war isn't over. And of course, when the news of Austerlitz does arrive a couple of months later, it's very clear that this war is not going to be settled anytime soon. So I think they use Nelson and his death as a piece of propaganda. They try and create this image of Nelson as a national martyr, as someone that has given his life for his country, and use this to try and prepare the nation for a war that they know is going to go on for a number of years. There's a very famous quote. We're not quite sure if he actually said it or not, but it's a good story, so I'll say it. William Pitt, the prime minister, who says, "You can, you know, roll up that map of Europe. We won't be needing it again for 10 years when he hears the news of Austerlitz. So for all of these reasons, the British state needs a victory, and Nelson has given them that. And that's why I think Nelson's funeral is conducted as it is, as not as a ceremony for family and friends. It's very much a national affair. This a huge procession up the River Thames. Tens of thousands of people come out to watch it. A very public funeral in St. Paul's Cathedral, where, of course, his body lies to this day. There had been a victory at Trafalgar, but the British state transforms this into a mythic legend of victory. We know, looking back, that the war continues for another 10 years. We know that the naval war even is still going on. A couple of months after Trafalgar, two large French fleets escape from Brest and cause havoc around the Atlantic world throughout 1806. So this war is still ongoing, and they use Nelson's death for very, very clear propaganda purposes.
Mariana, can you tell us something about how the defeat played out in Spain?
Spain was the country that learned most immediately of the battle because, of course, Trafalgar is a cape on the southern coast of Spain. And in the days after the battle, as Kenneth mentioned, there was a storm which resulted in lots of shipwrecked sailors and dead sailors being thrown ashore on the coastline near Trafalgar. And, of course, the remnants of the combined fleet returned to Spain. And so in Spain, it was impossible to keep it a secret what had happened. And it was even very publicly mourned and dealt with. There was an outpour of poetry even on the battle. And it's interesting what made it so significant even for later Spanish generations. One reason that needs to be considered is the political implications, because the British naval dominion of the Atlantic following the Battle of Trafalgar cut off Spain's contact to its South American colonies, which resulted in a lack of control over these colonies and in turn accelerated their move to independence. So for Spain, Trafalgar is a turning point in their history. And it was treated as such by the great Spanish novelist of the 19th century, Benito Pérez Galdós, who wrote a series of novels about the history of Spain in the 19th century, starting with a volume about Trafalgar, as the Spanish pronounce it. And he presented the battle as a tragedy into which the Spanish had been drawn by having fallen prey to foreign, in this case, French influence. Kenny mentioned that before, that the Spanish were very unwilling to enter this war, but somehow felt no choice with their dominant northern neighbor. So they found a way of interpreting their part in the battle as a kind of heroic sacrifice of specific officers and sailors. And in Madrid, there are still streets named after Gravina and Choruca, who both died in the battle. And there's even a street named after Trafalgar itself.
Kenny Johnson, what did Napoleon do to rebuild his navy after Trafalgar? Did he take a different view of it?
What happens is Napoleon kind of goes through two phases. The first one is in 1807, after the Peace of Tilsit kind of brings peace to the European continent. Napoleon looks for a quick way to rebuild his naval strength. As James mentioned, there's those two squadrons from Brest that sail out, but they're both destroyed or captured in 1806. And so Napoleon turns to appropriating existing navies from other smaller nations. First, he turns to Denmark. He's putting diplomatic pressure on Denmark, who has about 18 ships of the line, with the three more being built. Unfortunately for Napoleon, Britain will launch a sort of undeclared preemptive strike on Denmark, firing incendiary rockets into the town of Copenhagen, forcing the fleet to be surrendered. Not only the ships, but also crucial naval stores that Napoleon needs. Next, Napoleon will turn his sights on the Portuguese navy, a small navy of about 11 ships, but very high quality. And this is when Marshal Junot launches his invasion of Portugal. However, the Portuguese family is able to flee to Brazil with most of the ships. And so Napoleon is frustrated once again. And finally, in 1808, Napoleon launches his sort of clandestine invasion of Spain, who he's upset has spent more money rebuilding its army than its navy. And his instructions to the Marshal Murat, who's commanding the invasion, emphasizes constantly the need to seize the naval ports. And of course, that'll launch him into the Peninsular War. But frustrated again, because he's not able to really control Spain, from 1808 onwards, Napoleon sets out to rebuild the fleet himself. And if you actually look at maps of the French Empire, you can see that the expansion of the French Empire is very directly connected to the sea. It's the coastal areas that he directly annexes to France: Florence, the Illyrian provinces, Holland in 1810, Barcelona in 1812. It's all about getting direct control of these maritime assets of ports and manpower. At the same time, he builds canals and ports. The port of Antwerp is built up. The canal network extends from just from France all the way through to pretty much Denmark. And he also forces his satellite states to build up navies. The kingdoms of Holland and Italy, Naples and Spain, Napoleon is pushing them to build up naval forces that Napoleon assumes he'll have direct control over. And of course, as I mentioned, the other hard part to build is the manpower. And so what Napoleon will do is he'll create these large coastal flotillas in both the Atlantic and the Mediterranean as sort of a training ground for his sailors, as well as to provide coastal protection there to help train up the new generation of sailors. And by 1813, the French Navy is growing. They're now slow due to supply issues, but by 1813, I believe the French Navy is up to about 100 ships of the line and growing. So larger than it had ever been. So as James alluded to, the naval war doesn't end in 1805. The French definitely take a blow, but from pretty much 1808 to 1813, they're on the rise.
It's worth just adding that if you look at the number of ships that Britain takes off Napoleon, exactly as Kenny said, at Copenhagen and from Portugal, it's more ships than they sink or capture at Trafalgar. So, you know, if we're looking to think about Trafalgar in context, actually, these later actions are just as important, if not more important.
Have we talked enough about the example that Nelson gave to the British in terms of propaganda?
Nelson is used as an example at the time for propaganda purposes, as I've said, to the extent that there's a naval action later in the war, the Battle of Lissa, where the Captain Host, who's in command, declares, "Remember Nelson," as they're going into battle. So it's clear that in the Navy, Nelson became this sort of rallying call. Looking further beyond that into the 19th century, I think it's certainly true that Nelson becomes, you know, a Victorian hero. His private life, his more controversial parts of his private life, are quietly forgotten. And it's his sort of martial prowess that becomes the main thing that people remember about him.
Mariana?
I do not see so much Nelson or Trafalgar as part of a government propaganda machinery. There is the Navy that clearly has an interest in commemorating Nelson and Trafalgar. And there is a great popular attraction to the event and to the person of Nelson, rather than deliberate government action to use the event. I rather see a kind of grassroots movement, even in the commemoration throughout the 19th century. As you mentioned in passing, I think it was James, that his affair with Lady Hamilton really damaged Nelson's reputation. And with it, the treatment of the Battle of Trafalgar. After all, 10 years after Trafalgar, the war had raged on until the Battle of Waterloo. And it was really Nelson's fellow men from the Navy, namely Captain Hardy and the chaplain who had accompanied Nelson in his dying hours, who initiated a public subscription for the Trafalgar Monument, for Nelson's column on Trafalgar Square in the 1840s, and thus revived Nelson and recovered him from something like oblivion in the public sphere. And it was, again, the attempt, well, in that case of a political pressure group, the Navy League mostly, to push Trafalgar celebrations even throughout the empire, but with its main event on Trafalgar Square, and make Nelson and Trafalgar popular in order to support their propaganda for naval armament in general. But it didn't succeed as they had bargained for, because when they decided to stop spending their money for decorations, wreaths and the like, on Trafalgar Square, and created instead a special Trafalgar Fund to commemorate the battle, this Trafalgar Fund attracted much more payments than the membership of the Navy League did. And so the public imagination was drawn towards Nelson and Trafalgar much more than public policies.
Thank you. Can I have a final word from you, Kenny Johnson? How would you measure the impact of Trafalgar on France?
It's clearly a major blow and setback for Napoleon. But as James and I had mentioned before, it's definitely not a complete setback. The losses in 1806, as well as British efforts to deny the French control of the Danish and Portuguese fleets, have a lot more to do with hampering Napoleon's ambitions. But there's also a slow drain on the French Navy. Napoleon is, from 1806 to 1809, trying to keep control of his Caribbean colonies. He'll lose 11 frigates and 21 brigs and corvettes, something like 4,000 prisoners trying to maintain control of those colonies, you know. And when you couple that with all of those losses, you see there's this just steady drain of manpower as well as materiel. At the same time, I think it's important, you know, people often only pay attention to Napoleon and his maritime ambition around this time period, 1805. But it's really important to understand that Napoleon always had maritime ambitions. He wanted to be a naval officer when he was studying in school. He famously was partaking in several amphibious operations in the Mediterranean as a young officer. He planned for an invasion of Corsica in 94 that never took place. He personally organized the expedition to Egypt in 98. His invasion of Italy, he was very interested in expanding French Mediterranean control, looking at the Ionian Islands. And so when you look at what happens with Trafalgar, it doesn't really have that much of an impact. It's just Napoleon continuing this maritime ambition when in 1806, and I would often argue that it's the tail that wags the dog for Napoleon. So we often pay attention to the campaigns on land, but when you look at what's causing many of these famous battles that Napoleon is involved in, you see it's his maritime aspirations. So in 1806, his desire to get Sicily for Murat and later his brother is what helps provoke the war with Prussia. He starts to double deal with Hanover, offering Hanover back to the British in return for Sicily. And that helps lead Prussia to declare war. Napoleon's aspirations of getting Spanish sea power is what mires him in the Peninsula War. And Napoleon will spend vast amounts of money in terms of ships, manpower, infrastructure of ports and canals, and will help create some famous naval bases. Antwerp, La Spezia will all be these major investments by him. But again, Trafalgar itself, it's not the key for him.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Kenny Johnson, James Davey, and Mariana Chisnick. Our studio engineer was Nigel Dix. Next week, the rise of nationalism and communism in China in 1919 after the Treaty of Versailles, known as the May 4th Movement. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
What would you like to have developed or said that wasn't in the programme?
Probably I would ponder a bit about England Expects, if I may, because it
Please
connects
do.
the actual battle to the appeal that Nelson, I think, still holds. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, Mariana, his choice of word in terms of he uses England rather than Britain, which has always struck me as being an interesting word choice. And it was the British Navy. And we know for a fact that there were plenty of Welsh, Scottish, Irish sailors there, numerous people back in the British Isles that also felt they had a stake in this battle. Do you have any sense of why he used England rather than Britain?
Well, having studied in Edinburgh in Scotland, I'm well aware of the Scottish being left out as well as the Welsh and others. Well, I think in the 18th century, the term England wasn't so fixed on England alone. I've heard of the Scottish referring to themselves as North English, which they clearly weren't. So there wasn't an outspoken identity that would single out the English from the Welsh and the Scottish. And definitely, I think, in Nelson's mind, he wouldn't wish to differentiate between English and British. And perhaps it was easier to signal as well. I don't know.
It's probably something boringly practical like that.
Oh, it's a very good question. Dave, James, what do you think?
Yeah, like I say, it probably is something really, really practical, as Mariana suggests. I mean, I don't know enough about early 19th century signals technology to answer it in detail. I mean, it's just always struck me that, you know, one of the arguments that gets put forward about the Royal Navy in this period is that it was a nationalizing force. You know, it was very much a British force, and regardless of where you came from, you served in the British Navy on a British ship. It was quite distinct to, say, the Army, where you would join a regiment that was linked very precisely to a particular county in the UK. But the Navy is seen as this very British force, and certainly if you look at the sort of cultural produce of this period, it's British nature and used to support arguments about British national identity. So anyway, it's just always sort of struck me as an odd choice from Nelson. But as Mariana suggests, there may just be a really boring practical reason behind it.
Well, I can talk a little bit. What's really interesting is, you know, why does Napoleon end up picking Admiral Rozier, a man he was really not happy with and had passed over for command on several previous occasions? Why now is he picked? And so when Napoleon is looking to replace Villeneuve in October, he kind of goes through the list. And the primary choice is actually Admiral Viret Joyeuse, who's the Governor General of Martinique. Now, Napoleon wants to remove him in part because he's very cozy with Anglophile planters on the island. And so Napoleon kind of wants to remove him from that position. At the same time, he's the one competent general or admiral that he has left who has battle experience. But it's going to take too long to get him off the island. He still plans to do it even after Trafalgar, but it just never happens. And at the time, the only other two choices are Rosie and this other admiral named Martin, who commands the port of Rochefort. And what's interesting is at this point, de Creye finally reports that neither of those admirals actually want the job. And so you had Rosie, who had been constantly begging for an opportunity, probably saw how this was going to go poorly and was going to be maybe a bit more than he could chew. And so he doesn't really want the job. So I suspect that it may have led to Rosie taking his time to make his way to Cadiz. I don't have any proof, but I would suspect that he did not take any actions to hide his arrival, because he didn't want the job.
Do you think that Villeneuve has had rather a bad press?
I feel bad for him. He's someone who got promoted above his ability, put in a position where, you know, history is going to forever look upon him, right? And he's clearly not in the right. He's clearly has a fragile mental health. If you read his letters, he bounces from being very boastful in his ability to handle Nelson to he sees Nelson in the shadows and is afraid and as he famously flees the Caribbean quickly, he doesn't exude the same confidence that while he may have had some of the ability, he just doesn't have that confidence to provide the morale to his fleet, which James had mentioned before. And reports are that the morale of the Toulon fleet dropped when Letouche-Treville died and was replaced by Villeneuve, just because he didn't have that same presence like a Nelson to build that camaraderie amongst his commanders.
What do you three of you think about, what's your personal view about the qualities that made Nelson as he was?
He was clearly a very charismatic man. A lot of people were drawn to him, and one of his great skills, I think, was encouraging a sort of esprit de corps amongst him and his fellow officers. One of the reasons why I think Trafalgar, the British win at Trafalgar, is because every officer knew exactly what they had to do, because Nelson had essentially coached them over the previous weeks into exactly how he wanted them to fight the battle. So he was clearly a very talented leader, able to inspire devotion amongst the people around him. I mean, I think it's interesting, speaking from the perspective of the 21st century. I think he's becoming a more controversial figure now. Obviously,
in what way?
Well, he's tied to the growth of the British Empire in the late 18th and 19th century, and also some of his personal opinions do not look good in the light of 21st century days. So, you know, we know that he married into the planter class. We know he's on record as saying that he was very much against the abolition of slavery. It's particularly grating with Nelson for someone that spent so long in the Caribbean during his career. You know, he would have seen the brutality and exploitation that occurred on plantations, and, you know, still felt comfortable saying that he was against abolition. So I think as we look back on him now, he's a more complex figure than some biographers might allow.
Well, this is probably putting our contemporary stress on a remark that he made in passing, as far as I remember. So he was also very, well, I don't want to go too much further into this, rather return to the question about the qualities that he had and that made him such an outstanding figure, which in my view, in part, are simply his courage, moral and physical, that helped him to make his decisions in a very unbiased way. He, in part, decided in ways that we would think were unreasonable, like flouting his love affair to Lady Hamilton or disobeying orders, when he just felt, this is what I want to do, and had the courage to go for it. And this helped him to make clear decisions.
I would add, you know, having looked at Nelson's correspondence, I'd also say, while a lot of people focus on his aggressivity and how he's a sort of an aggressive commander, I think he's also a very strategic-minded commander. If you read his correspondence, he's always concerned about the larger situation. You know, Nelson is often sort of trying to anticipate what Napoleon is trying to do, and he doesn't chase after Villeneuve recklessly. He only does so once he learns that Villeneuve is heading to the Caribbean. And in fact, he even talks about, okay, should I head up to regroup with Cornwallis off the coast of Brest? Because he understands that the channel is the primary concern.
Thank you very much.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Hello, I'm Professor Steven Pinker. We all want to reason more clearly and to make better choices about everything from life and love to medicine and money. But even the best of us get things wrong.
I would have twice as many billions if I just made a different decision.
I mean, of course, one can always learn from other people's mistakes.
It's ideal to do that.
Each episode is a conversation with an expert on rationality and someone who deals with our corresponding irrationality in real life.
Rarely do we sort of walk around living out probabilities. Oh my God, wait, 90% prevalence. It's hard to sort of hold on to that in real life.
I hope you'll join us as we try to make sense of making sense and hopefully to make better decisions. That's Think with Pinker from BBC Radio 4. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.